guys, welcome back to the Ikecast. This is Chris, and I'm with my co-host, as always, Ike.
Hey guys, welcome to this Sunday. So normally we have our podcast on, we do our podcast on Saturdays, and we did it. But just at the tail end when we were signing off, Chris, where he is, for some reason, his whole neighborhood lost power. So whatever we discussed, we weren't able, the recording didn't happen. So you guys get us on a Sunday.
Yeah. It was freak power accident that like shut down the entire neighborhood. Like I live across from a school and I saw like the school lights go out. I saw like the it was closer towards the evening. So I saw like the street lamps go out. It was really strange. And then, you know, a couple of minutes later it popped up, but it was late enough. They were like, oh, let's just do it in the morning.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but
which is like odd.
Yeah, all in all, though, like we sort of like got through it, and then on the larger end of the scale, man, damn, just a lot of. I wish we could like, you know, it's gonna be somewhat still a little bit fresh because you know we went through it fairly quickly last night, and now we actually have a little bit more time in the morning to, you know, go through these topics. And one of the big ones, of course, was the January 6th commission, which was being voted on by the Senate, and didn't pass, even though it passed the House.
Right. Well, here's the thing is, you know, Chris, 11 senators skipped the vote. And of those 11, two of them were Democrats. And to me, that's insane. You know, Kristen Semina from Arizona, she wasn't there, and her office, and I say this in quotes, said she wasn't there because of family matters, right? I can understand family matters, some will take precedent, but you knew this vote was happening.
Yeah, I think it's a fairly easy thing to say that Kristen Sinema and definitely Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin, right? They rely on this, you know, like, so we're, you know, we're above partisan politics. We're reaching across the aisle. We need Republicans. I'm in a fairly Republican district, and I need to, you know, pretend to be as right leaning as I can, because, you know, that's the fundamental issue with the Democratic Party, is that there really is no left leaning, you know, side of it, right? Like, you have that progressive left, which is not representative of the party as a whole. Right, and you have people like Sinema and Manchin who want to, like, I have a feeling that they knew it was never going to pass, so they want to bring on that air of like, hey, listen, we weren't the guys who voted for it, so it's not on us, right?
Yeah, but here's the thing is, if you knew it was going to pass, then why not just vote?
Add your voice to it, right? It's, yeah, but it, I think it helps them for their districts. Like, you know, Sinema in Arizona, I think there is a general feeling among you know, the Democratic establishment that Arizona and Georgia are flukes and they can't rely on them. I would say,
which is a stupid way to look at it. You should be looking at, yeah, it's not a fluke. You need to look at the, you know, the,
like, these places delivered you your win because they believed in your message, right?
Yeah.
They believed in, you know, the things that you promised to give them, right?
Yeah.
Like, you, like, voting is not, you know, like a patriot, like, people want to think of it as like a patriotic duty. I always want to, you know, like, tamper that. Like, no, it's not. It's not this weird duty that, you know, you're not doing it for your country. You're doing it for you.
Right? Yeah.
You're always doing it for what is in your best interest and the best interests of whatever agenda that you may have. That, I don't have a problem with that. Why shouldn't people, you know, why shouldn't government work for their people, you know? And why shouldn't people have a say of what they want their government to do for them? That's not problematic for me at all, right? And the will of the majority has to be, you know, represented in a democracy.
Right, but the problem with January 6th is it was, the will of the majority was not being defended.
Absolutely.
Right? It was being attacked.
Absolutely. And so, what can I say? We have, you know, these senators who, you know, they're under this weird opinion that the only way that they'll, like, the only way that they'll be able to keep their seats or power is to, you know, is to pretend like they're Republicans. And the problem is that no one wants a Democratic senator who pretends to be a fucking Republican, right? If they wanted a Republican, they'd vote for one.
Right.
Right? If they wanted a Republican, they'd vote for one. Right? The reality is that they want these really popular, you know, I would argue as very populist, you know, policies. They want those to be enacted. Right? Incredibly popular policies like, you know, Medicare for All, the $15 minimum wage, all these sort of things. They want them to be enacted. Right? And it's not this, and what can I say? The January 6th, if you want to win an election on a purely, power grab level, like, you know, to be very, very effective, you got to do the Benghazi thing. You have to constantly harp and keep within the news, you know, the reality of January 6th. The difference between Benghazi was, you know, terrorist attack all the way in a destabilized part of, you know, the world versus an attempt to,
you know, overthrow our democratic processes.
Exactly. You know, and the question is, who was helpful? Who was complicit? Right? You know, the fact that some of these, you know, rioters and insurrectionists, you know, had working and good understanding of the layout of the building, you know, where to find people's offices, you know, fairly easily. At what point do we not take that into consideration? At what point do we not pause and think about who in the Capitol was complicit?
I think just from, you know, the rhetoric and the language that is being used, it's very easy to identify who was being complicit and was supporting the insurrection. I mean, you know, when you get sworn in as a member of Congress or a senator, you know, part of your oath is you vow to uphold, you swear to uphold the U.S. Constitution, and that's not what's being done.
Not at all, and I don't expect it to be done at all. I think that I think it's very, very clear that, you know, party politics has ruled the day for a while now, right? It's been that way forever. I mean, I'd like to say that, you know, in my lifetime, it started with Newt Gingrich and, in the 90s, right? And it's only expanded to people like, you know, the turtle himself, freaking McConnell, and...
He's unbelievable. He's like, I'm not going to vote for it because I don't want it to be political. Dude, it is political. You guys politicized Benghazi. And now you're saying their whole issue with the commission is the commission is going to continue into a voting cycle.
Absolutely. It's going to, the commission, and that's why they need to do just a simple congressional commission or a presidential commission, you know, screw the Senate. Right, just keep on doing it. Get it inside the zeitgeist. Get it inside people's, you know, normal lexicon that this is happening. You know.
Yeah, I mean,
there is this naked power grab that was attempted and failed, right? By the grace of like God, that everyone got lucky, that this thing failed so horribly. But we need to constantly remember that, you know, this is this was a close call, but this is the failure point of all democracies, right? It's always the transition of power. And demagogues like, you know, Donald Trump, who believe in fascistic tendencies, do not want to transfer power. In fact, they refuse to believe that they even lost the election. Right? They're treating the United States like a banana republic where the elections themselves cannot be trusted. Right? In states which are Republican controlled, and in the aftermath of the election, change the laws to make it, you know, harder for people to pull off a victory like that. You know,
it's absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah, the election system in the United States is without a doubt, you know, rigged. When you allow individual states to control and not a, you know, independent third party. You know,
yeah.
The problem is that where is the across the board, you know, universality, you know, for voting, right? Every single voting, you know, every single ballot looks different from state to state, even from county to county.
But Chris, that's fine.
No,
that's fine.
I think that.
No, no, but We okay, so you know what? In the 60s, we passed, the U.S. passed voting rights.
Yeah.
Right? Those voting rights, and those were federal voting rights. What states had to do at a minimum. Remember, you know, the U.S. is unique in that we have a federal and we've got the state, and those powers that are not clearly defined in the at the federal level are the responsibility or the powers of the state.
So in Canada, we have a similar situation, except it's reverse. It's the right. powers of the state are, well, the powers of the province is enumerated. The powers of the federal government are whatever is left. And
right.
whatever is also enumerated for them. Right? They have, like, the leftover residual power in the United States goes to the individual states on the state level. Well, it's on the federal level here in Canada. Done on purpose, by the way, mainly because, you know, in the aftermath of the Civil War, you know, Canadian government is being formed, and they're like, yeah, we don't want any of that.
Well, here's the thing is, you know, other countries and states have learned from, have taken the...
American example.
Yeah, American example, and have adjusted it to their own thinking, right? But it first was derived or arrived at in the United States.
Yeah. And,
okay.
And what can I say? We are in a... Precarious is not the right word. We are in a position in time where there's going to be a lot of...
There is. It just, you know, the Republican Party has... it's... Instead of investigating what needs to be investigated, look at, you know, 9/11. 9/11, we were attacked from the outside, right? External forces attacked the United States. January 6th, it was internal domestic terrorist forces that attacked Capitol Hill. Yeah. I mean, that has to be recognized. That has to be continued to, you know, we have to always remember this day. We can't forget it. Right?
Yeah. No, there's a reckoning that America needs to deal with, right? Like an internal, because the United States has had...
Well, I think there's a couple of reckonings I think the U.S. has to deal with and address. And I think, you know, we can no longer just think, oh, yeah, no, it doesn't exist, right?
Or it can't happen here, right?
It can't happen here, exactly. I mean, I think underlying all of this is... you know, the sins of the past that still have not been addressed. And when I talk about sins of the past, I'm talking about slavery. I'm talking about white supremacy.
The Native American genocide.
Yeah, the Native American genocide.
Yeah, no.
You know, the Tulsa massacre.
You saw that? I there was an Oklahoma senator who was talking about the Tulsa massacre recently. I believe it's almost 100 years since the Tulsa massacre, or it has been 100 years.
Right. And Chris, we've talked about this. You know what? Black Americans might be aware of it, but I don't think most Americans were aware of it until Watchmen.
So one of the individuals who definitely brought it to the attention of someone like David Lindelof when he was doing Watchmen was it was an Atlantic article by Ta-Nehisi Coates, who is right now going to be he was announced to be writing the new Superman film, the new Black Superman film.
Okay.
He is a person with many controversial opinions on the nature of race relations within the United States, to say the least. But nevertheless, he did, you know, reveal this part of American history for the most part, which has been hidden, for lack of a better word. It's been sort of, you know, prevented, and we really haven't been able to, you know, gain an insight into this point in history, which for the most part has been kept from us. And listen, I'm a Canadian, right? Me not knowing, you know, the Tulsa race massacre is an aspect mm-hmm. of, you know, it not just being within my sphere of influence and nation, right? But on the other side of events, like, we have what is clearly, you know, like, one of the worst, you know, perpetrated acts of, like, you know, organized lynching.
Yeah.
Right? That there ever was.
Yeah.
And no one no one talked about it. The people who knew about it were few and far between. It was, what can I say? The lack of knowledge in and of itself was shameful, right? And the fact that it wasn't in the public consciousness at all, and that we had to get it from a TV show about superheroes.
Yeah.
Who are fundamentally corrupt in themselves.
Yeah.
Right, like that's how we had to get that sort of knowledge. It's disgraceful, it's shameful, and it really just shows that, you know, people don't want to acknowledge their own histories.
Yeah. But we need to, and this leads back to, you know, January 6th, right? I mean, Donald Trump in his 2016, 2015, his whole, you know, make America great again, you have to really ask yourself, what time frame is he talking about when he says make America great again? He's talking about the 50s and 60s. And when was America, who was America great for in the 50s and 60s? It wasn't people of color. It wasn't Asian Americans, right? It wasn't Black Americans. It was a distinct group. And I think January 6th is very much a large part of that anxiety, fear that the hierarchy is changing.
Yeah, you often hear people talk about, you know, we don't want to become a minority in our own country, right? You know, and I hear that. I see that. Like, why are you afraid of becoming a minority in your own country unless it sucks to be a minority?
Right.
Right? And that's the thing that I think people are really getting is how crappy... Like, I think they realize, being a minority in the United States is not the best thing in the world, and they don't want to be it either because how shitty they treated minorities for the longest time.
Right.
Right? So, yeah, no, it's. I think definitely that there is a case for...
And I want to be clear, Chris, you know what? I'm not saying everybody holds it. Those individuals who came to Capitol Hill... that was what was, I think, a major thing that was driving them was the fear.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and they were whipped up into fear that, you know, of some irrationality. I mean, a lot of these people have been, like, I know plenty of people who, like, here have bought into the anti-vax, anti, you know, mask sort of sentiment, right? And... you know, thinking that this is just a power grab by the government, right? Mm-hmm. In Canada, right? Okay. I mean, it can happen anywhere, but I don't understand, like, where people's fears are coming from, especially involving this. But nevertheless, you know, a hard, long look at January 6th needs to be done.
Yeah.
And then... by that same sort of, you know, logic and tone, we need to have a hard look at, you know, at the people who caused it. Because right now there is no accountability, right? And that's what we need. I mean, we can't run... I've been hearing this thing about President Trump, former President Trump, which, you know, feels fundamentally true to me. And that is, you know, like there is a push for... him to essentially, you know, run again for president just so he can stave off, you know, criminal investigation. You know, it's like that's where we are right now, is that we've made it so that the president is immune from crime, you know, criminality. And in order to get that, he needs to continually try to, you know, run and become president, see if he can pardon as much people as he can. You know, that's where we're in, right? Illegality, you know, immorality, you know, lack of ethical behavior. All these things are not only, like, they're not only valued, but it's the sort of credo of the current Republican Party. You know, and that's what they need to do in order to win.
Maybe I'm, like, really naive, Chris. I just, you know what, I have a really hard time, you know, understanding or seeing this happening, right? Like, I just...
I can easily say, without a shadow of any irony, that this is it doesn't make any sense, and it's horrifying to say the least.
Yeah, because look at what they did with Benghazi. I keep bringing it back, right? Benghazi, they like, that was completely political. It was Republicans. Like, they had Hillary Clinton sit for 11 hours of testimony. One sitting. It wasn't, they didn't break it up. She sat for 11 hours and took their questions. And it wasn't one person. It was like the whole Republican, you know, committee, people, you know, Republicans who were on that committee, they like, they hammered at her.
Yep.
Right? And don't tell me that wasn't political. You know, this is not political. There was, and I, you know what? I have to question, what are you afraid of? I think you're afraid, they're afraid that they know that, you know what, it's going to come out, how complicit a lot of people were.
Yeah, the politicization of all of this is because it is political, right?
Yeah.
Because there are people involved who, in their political ideology, you know, thought that the solution to an election was to cheat, was to lie, was to pretend like they always won. There's a lot having to, there's a reckoning that needs to be dealt with. And
yeah.
What can I say? The January 6th commission not being passed by the Senate is shameful to say the least.
Extremely. I think it is extremely shameful.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, oh, is there any other big news this week? I mean, other than like that horrendous event?
Well, we know that the House has passed the commission. Oh, yes, there's a couple of them. So this week we had another round of mass shootings. There's a mass shooting in San Jose. You know, it was I think it was the MTA in San Jose that, and they lost 11 souls to this mass shooting. I think in the beginning of the week, there was mass shooting in New Jersey. And Chris, this morning I woke up to mass shootings on the East Coast again. I don't understand. Yeah, here it is. It was in Florida. Two dead, at least 20 injured in a Florida club from last night. We had... earlier on, early in the week, we had the shooting at a workplace.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that is just indicative entirely of. that's entirely just indicative of. Of just the current state of gun culture within the United States, mainly that it is easy to obtain these firearms, right? While there is a half decent process, right? It's not everywhere, right? And it's not equivalent across the board, you know. And then on top of that, once you get it, it's like, you know, there's you have the ability to cause so much carnage at a mass scale, right? With relatively little oversight once you actually obtain the weapon, right? You could be someone, you know, who has so there's two types of gun crime, right? And both of them have completely different means of addressing them. One is criminal gun crime, you know, done with illegally obtained firearms, right?
Yeah.
And used for the purpose of, you know, for the most part, criminal enterprise, right?
Yeah.
But on the other side of events, we have we have another thing, which is legally obtained firearms, which are, you know, involved in gun crime. And this is what usually will lead to mass shooters. They obtained all their guns legally, right? They represent a smaller amount, but they are a lot more drastic.
Yeah.
Right? A mass shooting is a lot more sensational, right, than the constant, you know, barrage of gun deaths, you know, that happen in any given, you know, city around the United States. But, yeah, I don't know what the solution is because, you know, is the solution taking away the guns? You know,
yeah,
is that the solution? I'm not sure it is. I think the best solution is a full on licensing regime. Right? I think that the process of obtaining a license, right, will deter a lot of people, as opposed to just the normal process as it is right now, where, you know, some places require licensing, like
New Jersey.
Yeah, New Jersey and several other states. Other places, in Canada, they require, like, full-on testing regimes, and you have them passing exams, like, you know, like it was a driving license. All right, a practical and a non-practical segment. I think that might be a solution. I think that when you see Australia and Canada, which had, you know, we've had mass shootings in the past, right? We've reduced it significantly, right?
Yeah.
Due to, you know, the changes in the gun laws, which allowed for this. New Zealand and Australia similarly. And it was greatly in Australia is a largely rural, you know, nation, right? Out there in the bush where there's dangerous stuff, they have tons of firearms.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not surprising to me at all.
Right.
That the solution might be to, you know, to take away some firearms, but in the American context, I think that's a nigh impossibility. It is a constitution. It is a right as opposed to a privilege. In every other nation, it is a privilege. It is not a right. And
well, interestingly enough, there was a new book that came out that was looked into the Second Amendment, right? Because that's what the Second Amendment is, that the belief, the enshrinement of an individual's right to own guns, right? Mm-hmm. And this new book is really delving into was the Second Amendment, you know, this author is arguing that the Second Amendment wasn't really to protect one's home against an invading force, but it was more to control African Americans and continue to keep them powerless and vulnerable. Which is why the Second Amendment, you know, the well-regulated militia component of it was to deal with any type of potential slave revolts. Now, this is an interesting take on, you know, interpretation of the Second Amendment, but she does look at debates from the founding fathers in making this argument. So the question is, you know, Chris, you know, yeah, I agree with you. There should be some nationalized licensing format. You know, it's especially when, you know, the guns cross state lines, then you have interstate commerce that gets impacted, right?
Kyle Rittenhouse, right?
Yeah, right, you know, right. Went from Illinois to Wisconsin, right?
I thought it was Minnesota.
Or Minnesota. Okay. He crossed state lines. With his gun.
A firearm in which someone else bought for him, which is
right.
A huge, huge felony. Right? Like, there's... What can I say? When it comes to... The United States is a big place, right? And because interstate commerce allows people to move, there needs to be some sort of regulation. Now, the problem is the federal government is not like Canada, right? It doesn't have, you know, the ability to focus and limit that regulation like that, especially when it comes to the political will involving something like firearms. Which is such a it's a topic that, you know, automatically turns you off to single issue voters.
You
know, I don't blame them. It's like that's the issue that they care about, fine, but they're gonna have to come into, you know, they're going to have to come to context with that, you know, their favorite hobby is soon going to be, you know, it's only eventuality. I just don't know what it's going to look like and what the changes are going to be, right? And how are they going to implement them? But at some point, this has got to, it's got to be enough, right? Enough has got to be too much.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's my only thing. It's enough has got to be just a little too much now. And
A large part of this whole Second Amendment debate was the NRA, right? And their lobbying group. But the NRA right now, I don't think it's a strong organization. It's in Chapter 11. It's facing bankruptcy. I think when you don't have that organized clout behind you, the ability to make changes that are better for society ends up happening because that self-interest isn't there.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, push. Like, the NRA especially has had a lot of issues with, you know, Chapter 11, you know, source of funding, you know, whether it comes from, I believe some of their source of funding comes from Russia. You know, like, they have a lot of issues, right? And I believe they're moving to either Florida or Texas, you know, because of their Chapter 11 in New York. Right, there's a lot for them to do, and for the most part, they're not an organization that has been for a lot of gun rights throughout history, right? You know, they were for the limitation of gun rights during the era when the Black Panthers were you know getting firearms, right?
Yeah.
You know the Black Panthers who would later be actively discriminated against, and then you know, as we saw in like other things like in films that came out this year. You know, actively assassinated by members of, you know, the federal government and the FBI. So, yeah, that civil rights era is filled with, you know, these sort of like horrendous moments that, you know, like I said, there's a reckoning that needs to be dealt with. There's a million sins in the United States that have yet to have been sort of examined in any real way, you know?
Mm-hmm. But I think, Chris, the NRA's move to, I think, Texas was blocked by a federal court judge who dismissed their bankruptcy case. Because the federal court's judge, his reasoning was that you can't use us to avoid, avoid the case that's happening in, you know, avoid the lawsuit that's in New York. Like, you can't do that. You can't form shop. We're not going to allow you to do that. Hey, and I believe it was a Texas court, a Texas judge that made that determination too.
Texas is another place that, you know, we're going to have to keep a very close eye on because in the future.
I think it will be turning purple.
Yeah, absolutely. It's turning purple now. We have a mass exodus sort of out of California, which is bringing, you know, those people into there. You know, California is in this weird, very, very precarious position. I mean, you saw, like, Caitlyn Jenner's trying to run for governor, right?
Yeah, Caitlyn Jenner, I think, is a hack. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, she, what can I say? It's like she didn't stop being a bad person just because she changed her gender, right?
Right.
You know, and so I think this, what can I say? I have no interest or sympathy inside of, like, her presidential race and her gubernatorial race. And right now, her race includes, my friends just see too many homeless people and they're leaving California. I want it out. We're going to end cancel culture. We're going to end it's like, what can I say? It's like, and then on top of that, she's a Republican.
Right.
Right? It's like the cognitive dissonance here is
Yeah, well, I love, you know, how they say, well, we're going to end cancel culture, we're not going to allow it, blah, 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 right? But they're the ones who are using that cancel culture.
I mean, yeah, it's not like...
Yeah, hypocritical.
I think everyone... Here's the thing. I'm not going to pretend like the liberal media does not use cancel culture or that liberals don't.
I don't either, but the right do too.
Yeah, but the right pretend like they don't. And it's like, right. Of course you guys do. Everyone does. It's like you don't like someone based on their opinion or whatever. And you determine that, yeah, it's best if, you know, like we deplatform them. Deplatforming goes across the board, across the entire spectrum.
Yeah.
And it is entirely, I think, caused by and a symptom of a general... I'm trying to get there's a general, like, hatred of free speech going on right now.
Yeah.
Right? Thinking that the solution might be to just, you know, limit or damage. Right? And free speech is one of those strange things because... It has to be very, very, like, in the United States, it's very hard to limit free speech. It has to be, you know, clear threats of violence are the only thing that's going to stop someone's free speech.
Right.
Right? And then, as we've learned, the clear threats of violence, it's a high bar to pass, right? Like, you can burn the flag in the United States. It's totally legal. Like, they're not going to stop you there, right? Even
right.
Some may want to stop it. All in all, just, you know, Caitlyn Jenner, the state of the Republican Party, all of it's going to be an interesting sort of distraction. And I'd like to see how well Caitlyn Jenner does, because her entire career is not going to be, she's going to be on focus, whether or not it's going to be about her policy or her celebrity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
right,
I think with Donald Trump, we learned that policy didn't freaking matter, and if the policy was there, it was straight up abhorrent, right? But the everything else involved in it, right? I think there's a huge sort of push. They're really trying to legitimize someone like Caitlyn Jenner with, all of her abhorrent ideas and everything that she believes in.
Yeah, and I have a really hard time understanding how she could have those beliefs.
Listen, I don't want to say this because some people might think of it as offensive, but these beliefs are not surprising for, a conservative white dude.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
And I'm not saying that he is a conservative white dude, but he is a conservative white woman now.
Right.
And so his ideas, his beliefs, they're not, in my opinion, they're while while I don't agree with them, they are easily representative of who he is.
Okay. Well, I think on that note, I would like to pivot to our happy place.
That's true. Let's get out of here. Let's go to the happy place.
Although before we do that, I'm going to challenge both you and me, Chris, to change it up a little bit. And I want us to introduce at least one feel-good story that we can talk about going forward. Yeah, I know. That's why I said I'm going to challenge.
Yeah, a horrendous challenge.
Doesn't matter. I'm going to challenge us to do this. Okay? Mm. All right. Well, on that note, we're going to go to our happy place.
Yeah. All right. Now we're in the happy place, away from all of the horrible stuff that we've normally had to deal with.
Okay. Oh. Before we go, can I get a three-minute pause?
All right. Yeah. We'll be right back with our happy place, guys. We'll see you then. And we're back to the happy place. All right. So this time on the happy place, we're going to be discussing almost everything to do with Zack Snyder again. That's just
a little right.
And of course, a show that is made by Zack Snyder's mortal enemy. So I want you to start it off. Let's start off with the Nevers. What did you think?
I liked it. The Nevers, spoilers, guys. So the Nevers is set in Victorian era London. It's almost like a Victorian set of X-Men sort of thing. But the premise is that there's this ship that, or something in the sky that everybody sees, and it, as it's floating over London, it's releasing these lights, and whoever gets hit with the light gets touched, and they start experiencing certain powers, right? So somebody can see in the future, somebody has this, it just, I think, amplifies their innate abilities for the most part, right? They have.
That's
so
what it definitely feels like, yeah.
It just amplifies what was already there. Because, if you think about the character that is their mechanical genius, right? Is it Q of James Bond?
The quartermaster, yeah.
Yeah, right. The quartermaster, right? Very similar in role as that. She comes, up with all of these gadgets and things that are going to be that are, help the touched, right?
Yeah.
That they are. So anybody who's been touched, their innate abilities, I think, get amplified. And the reason why I say that is because in the very beginning, what is your character's name? Is it Patience or Prudence?
With the inventor?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's Prudence or Patience.
Prudence, right? Sorry, guys, I You know, it's been like almost 2 weeks. I don't have all of the
I was a late one to it. It's like I was actually ahead of you on it, and then I stopped. Like literally, the sixth episode came out, and then I watched that one.
Right. So so the reason why I say I think it brings out their innate abilities is because when she was touched by those lights. You saw, you know, she was like trying to pump some water and the pump wasn't working. And so she took a clip and she, you know, inserted and she was able to make it work. So I think it's just, you know, the innate abilities that one has gets amplified by if they've been touched. And most think that, you know, the touched are those who were of the lower classes. But we learn in the, you know, in the episodes that no, it was whoever... whoever the lights landed on, so to speak, right?
Yeah, and I mean, so the sixth episode really explained a lot more in the show and like the world and going around. But yeah, you're right. It's like foundationally, it's just it's Victorian X-Men, right?
Right.
We have you know, we have clearly this group of gifted individuals who have the innate ability to. Do you know, like, just superpower stuff. So, and then on top of that, it's like there's this just general mission of trying to obtain and find the person who gave them their powers, the thing that gave them their powers. And yeah, the first episode you see what it is, but you don't have really any good understanding of what it is, right?
Yeah.
You know, you see it, but you don't really know what the hell is it. It's so strange, right? The way it looks.
Yeah, and we're just so it's obviously an alternate United Kingdom or Great Britain, right?
Yeah.
We don't know how it's gonna progress, but there's clearly a war that they're all preparing for, right? And we don't know if the touched are gonna be the good or the bad.
Yeah, because so episode 6 really does a lot of the heavy lifting and explaining the. You know, the world.
The origin.
Yeah, the origin of what's going on. And yeah, there's this strange war in the future, which looks like between humans, you know, and the subject of the war seems to be these aliens that get, the character of Amalia, you know, says it, you know, like to Prudence or Patience or whatever her name was, that, aliens from the future gave us superpowers. Like, that's all it is. And I was like, okay, that's a very easy way to just explain it. You know, aliens in the future gave us superpowers. But, like, what is the war in the future about? And it feels like the war was caused by these aliens just by virtue of them existing, right? Like, you have, like, these religious, pseudo-religious fundamentalists who are anti-alien, right? And, like, they were torturing the alien, they were doing whatever. But I feel like if this is the case, if the foundational problem in this war is, us versus the alien, right? It might be that, the Scalanthi, this alien thing that gave them their powers, is the reason why all this shit went bad.
See, I don't think so. I think there was a war already in place, and the Galanthis came... to try to help, and it just, broke the factions even more. Because I don't think they came the same way that they did in, at the start, right?
So, one of the things that we see in the first episode was, not in the first episode, in the sixth episode, was all that Victorian stuff that they had in that future facility. Right?
Yeah.
Like, you could tell, like, all right, so we're going to be doing, something, right? Like the time travel back to Victorian times was always the plan, because it's sort of like their way to figure out how to fix this, right? And the only way to fix it is to go deep into the past and start giving people superpowers, right? We'll see, because right now the question is, what is the war? Why is it like, you know, like the good guys don't share their goddamn names? Like, is that like some sort of cultural thing? The very fact that, you know, the other side was just sharing their name freely like we do in normal society. Like, it was very strange. Like, I'm like, are these the bad guys? Because what they're, you know, talking about, you know, is like, hey, do we know even that the Galanthi is here to save us? Right? There's a lot in the story as it is that makes me go like, I don't know who the good guys are in this future war. Right, I don't know who the good guys are. because they're going to, like, there's going to be some very, very clear examples of, like, yeah, these guys are the bad guys. You know, they tortured, you know, this sort of thing. They killed the science team. But, like, yeah, we don't know what these other guys have done.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting world that's being created. So here's confession time, right? I wasn't sure if I was going to watch it, Chris, because, you know, as I've said, I referenced that Josh Whedon was helming it. But, and, you know, some might say, okay, this is a cop-out and this is, you know, just a justification. But it wasn't just Josh Whedon. Like, there's, you know, the actors that were involved. I mean, all of them, you know, there's a lot more than just a Josh Whedon, right? Yeah. And so I would like to, you know, think that I'm supporting them. Like, they shouldn't be brushed with the same stroke as, you know, or stroke with the same brush as Josh Whedon, right? And they should be given a chance for this to be explored some more.
Yeah, absolutely. There is an important exploration that of these characters that needs to be pushed into place, right?
Yeah.
And what can I say? My only thing is, like, you know, as good as the show is right now, right?
Yeah.
It's only 6 episodes. This doesn't feel like a series finale, more like a mid-season, you know, break.
Yeah, it's not a series finale. I think, so they actually have 12 episodes and they broke it up into 2 parts. So there is a second part coming, which is the remaining six episodes. And I don't know if it's going to go beyond that. I hope it does. But again, I'm going to reserve judgment because you know how it could start off strong and then it could just fizzle. And if it fizzles, then I don't want, then I'd be like, okay, it would be sad. But because I think there's a lot here that you can build on, because we don't know what, you know, we don't know what the war is. We don't know if the war is, you know, we don't know if the factions that are in the future are now just being accelerated into the past, right? Because it does seem like there is a conflict going on between the touched and the untouched.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, right?
The conflict that it was in the future seems to have started again in the past just by virtue of the Galanthi being there. So it might be one of those very, very clear things that the Galanthi is the reason for all of this. Right, it's just by virtue of its existence, it created this war that's going to destroy the world, because there's going to be those who believe in it and those who don't, and it's going to be maybe a fundamental folly of people that in the end, you know, it's like we can't live with others. Who knows how they deal with it? I do know that I'm very still unclear about the nature of the war, the nature of why they need to stop it, what the Galanthi is, if the Galanthi is even a good guy, right?
Right.
Because, you know, like, we don't know. We know the Stripe, you know, doesn't even think of herself as a good guy. Being, you know, inside of, you know, a dead person.
Right, right, right.
You know, like, there's a lot. I'm unsure. Like, without Joss Whedon, right? If he ever comes back. I don't know if he
will. I don't think so. I think he's too toxic.
Yeah, so, like, there's the, and, you know, case in point, right? It's like, how is the show going to continue with a different showrunner, right? Is it going to be what, you know, they were building up to in the first place? They had to stop at 6 episodes in, you know, and sort of at, like, this midway point, but I don't know, like, will this show continue on HBO Max,
right,
considering the toxicity of Joss Whedon? I do not know. What can I say? All in all, though, I did enjoy it.
Yeah, I did too. I think it was well done. And a large part of it, though, I think, is the chemistry between the actors.
Yeah.
I think actors did really well.
Yeah, no, I think the crew is generally very great, but there's, I'm just waiting on what I think will be the next sort of big step, right? I'm unsure, like, where the show is going to go, and now with the sort of controversy around its, you know, showrunner and creator, I don't know where they're going to push that one forward, right?
Well, here's my belief is that, you know what, when one does a pitch to an HBO, right, they usually have a 3-5 season arc that, yeah, you know, because they're not going to say, okay, this is what we're going to do in season 1, 2, 3, this is how it's going to go, right? I don't think he would have gotten green light without them being some sort of arc. Yeah, they did that with Westworld. They did that with Game of Thrones, right? So I think there's when it's a multi-season, they have to give an arc. So I think if they have that arc, there's a lot of creative people out there. You know what? It's not just Josh Whedon in the world that can come in. Like, look what he did to Justice League. Like, he completely pissed on it. So I don't give him the credit that he's the only genius around or good storyteller. There's so many good storytellers. Our guy, Zack Snyder, is an amazing storyteller.
No, some would disagree, but nevertheless, I'm with you. I agree with you. But what can I say? Like, this show definitely had those specific Joss Whedonisms, right?
Yeah.
Things that we enjoyed from Buffy and Angel and Firefly, you know?
Okay, so confession, Firefly I've seen, as well as Serenity. Have not seen all episodes of Buffy or Angel.
That's fair. I mean, it's an old show. Firefly is one of those really easy to consume pieces of medium because it was one season in a film, right?
Yeah, it's so sad. That one would have been like a really cool, amazing show to continue with.
I wonder about that because, like, there are some Joss Whedonisms that I really hate.
Right? Oh, really? Like what?
Joss Whedon has got this weird problem where he's got to kill off fucking characters all the time. Like, that's his sort of go-to dramatic, like, moment, is to kill off a character.
Okay.
Usually out of nowhere and out of the blue. And so you see it in this show, too. It's like, you know, like, they started something, boom, character gets killed off for no reason, and it doesn't make any sense. Right? Like, everyone, that character of Molly, like, they just shot her out for no reason, and it made no sense to anything.
Oh, yeah. Yep. The singer.
Yeah, because that, like, it's a Joss Whedonism. He uses, like, a random unforeseen death, right, to
shock you into keeping interested
or
engaged.
And no, but he does it in everything, right? It's like you have to look at, like, he did it in the first Avengers movie,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, he killed off a character that they immediately brought back in a television series,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Like, because they weren't ready to kill off that character yet. So... And that television series, as I understand it, is not even canon anymore. So, like,
It's not. Yeah, they've taken it out of.
Yeah, it's like I have no idea why people watch it. The entire point of watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was that it was supposed to be canon, right? It was supposed to be like this, you know, continuation of the story, and then we find out it wasn't canon, and you know, all that time that people spent on it didn't really, like, it doesn't affect the modern sort of universe at all, right?
Right.
They sort of went crazy, did their own thing. I think that's the general problem that Marvel TV had, right, was that it was split across so many different services.
Yeah.
And they didn't have, like, a cohesive sort of canon plan for all of it. Like all the events of, like, the Netflix Marvel shows didn't amount to anything.
Yeah.
And on the other side of events, we have, what's Marvel's doing now with their Disney Plus shows, which are so heavily deep with inside the MCU. So
yeah.
So I like the way that they're doing it. It's like they're really doing event style shows in the MCU for the sake of just moving forward the in between story of the films.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's like the. I mean, if there ever was like corporate synergy, this is it, right?
Yeah.
There is one thing. Do what with us waiting on a whole bunch of new shows, right? And you know, like we got through, you know, the Nevers, Army of the Dead's done, and I want to talk very briefly about Zack Snyder, Army of the Dead, and some upcoming projects. We're just sort of waiting on stuff. There is a show that I think you might enjoy that is on Disney Plus, I believe. It's called The Bad Batch. It's a Star Wars show.
Okay, I haven't seen that yet. I know that they were going to. Have they started it?
Yeah, so they started it. Showed up on May the 4th. I believe this is only like 5 episodes out so far in a 16 episode season. But it's like, so I'm not the biggest fan of like Star Wars animation or like the Star Wars shows or anything like that. I like The Mandalorian, like everyone else, but like there was plenty of Star Wars shows before The Mandalorian, like The Clone Wars and Rebels and all that sort of stuff, and I wasn't too deep into that, but my brother was, and like he convinced me, he goes like, all right, The Clone Wars season 7 ended, It's like, watch the seventh season. And the thing about season seven is that it, and the seventh season, is it introduces these new characters called the Bad Batch, Clone Force 99, who are, they are defective clones, but intentionally. They're not perfect. They have, you know, genetic changes inside of them to make them more effective in individual roles. And as part of that, though, they're inhibitor chips that all the clones are given to help them eventually kill the Jedi. They don't work that well. So they're this group of clones that survived the events of Order 66 and then went on the run. And
okay.
So, like, their adventures.
Hence the Bad Batch.
Yeah. Well, no, they were called the Bad Batch the whole time.
Okay.
Right? Because, like, all the clones would make fun of them because they're all different, right?
But, right, right.
So, like, what can I say? It's a show that immediately takes place after the events of the Clone Wars, but it continues on with the events of the post Revenge of the Sith era into the New Hope era. One of the things that they did is that because this is also being run by the guy who did Mandalorian, there's a lot of not Jon Favreau but Dave Filoni. There's a lot of, like, Mandalorian, like, hints that they're going into, like, specifically. Do you remember that character in the Mandalorian, Fennec Shand?
Yep.
Yeah, like the sharpshooter who's wanted by, you know, ISB and all that sort of stuff. She's in this freaking show. Like, she's in the show, same character, same voice, same actress playing the voice, right? You know, hunting after the Bad Batch because she at this time was a bounty hunter. There's a lot of, like, right now, like, there's a whole bunch of cross-pollination going in because there's two eras in Star Wars history that have very, very little, you know, active lore in them. Right, active
yeah. and
canon lore, which is the post Return of the Jedi era, which is the Mandalorian,
right?
Right? And then the post Revenge of the Sith era.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, and
they're doing a pre Phantom Menace era with this whole new High Republic line of publishing that they're doing. But yeah, there's a whole bunch of shows coming out, and the Bad Batch is surprisingly a good one. It's an animated show, but its budget is great, and. What can I say? It's like, because they're still all fundamentally clones, you have the same guy doing the voice for all of them, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, so that's a show I would recommend, and it's only 5 episodes long, and what can I say? And all in all, it's really good, and you see a lot of, like, origin stuff for the things that we see, like, later on. Like in Mandalorian, when they talk about chain codes, like, where the hell did that come from? We never saw that in the, you know, in the sequel or the prequel trilogy.
Right.
We'll see. You see a lot of stuff on how it was established, and that's the point of prequels, right? Is to fill in the blanks of, wait, how did that person get to there in the first place? And so, jumping away from that, as a possible show for us to watch, I want to touch quickly upon Zack Snyder's Army of the Dead and potential future solo projects that he's going to be doing. Army of the Dead, has been nothing but a great hit for Netflix.
Oh, I, you know what? I've said it last week and I'm going to say it again. I really enjoyed it. And I know you've gone back and looked at it, watched it again. I haven't had that opportunity. I'm going to, because you know what? There's stuff that I want to, like, pay attention to, like robot zombies,
yeah.
Right? That's potentially there. You know, I know when you and me have talked about the, you know, are they in a time loop? And, you know, I've said this before, you know, Zack Snyder is such a great visual artist and storyteller. You know, every song that he plays, I think has a deeper meaning.
Dude, the acoustic cover of the Cranberries, what was that song called?
It was called Zombies.
Zombie, yeah. It's like, Jesus, yeah. I was like, that's great. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Smart move, guys. Smart move. Like, everything. Like,
Leave a Lost. He uses my favorite. Yeah. Yeah. Leave. I keep playing. He always, you know, they're always songs that I've loved. And it's just like, he's yeah, just
Zack
awesome.
Zack Snyder play, like, has a really good musical choice. Him and Tarantino, I really enjoy their musical choices.
Yeah.
And so.
I enjoy Snyder's over Tarantino.
Well, Tarantino is, like, really eclectic musical choices that I've never heard of. And then it goes, oh, that's pretty cool. That's pretty interesting. And then Zack Snyder just plays the hits, you know?
Right. Yeah.
He just plays the hits, like, oh, I forgot about this song. It was so awesome.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, all in all, I'm very excited about the entire, like the Army series, right? Army of the Dead, Army of the Dead,
right.
Army or whatever. The fact that, you know, like, characters are dead, but they're doing prequel stories for them, and there's this whole time loop theory. I'd love to think that, holy crap, you know, like, the time loop continues, right?
Right.
You know, like, there's a lot that I'm really excited about when it comes to, you know, like, pushing this. And, like, you see, like, how much, like, love and, like, freedom Zack Snyder is getting from Netflix, more so.
Oh, and look how it paid off, yeah, right?
Like, yeah, I think... Here's the thing, Zack Snyder, like, he made bangers for Warner Brothers, and they wanted him to do their stuff, right? He
right.
made 300 right. for them, right?
And right.
it came in under budget, under time, made a ton of money, right?
Yeah.
Everyone loved it, right? People thought it was racist for stupid reasons, right?
Right.
People didn't realize that this, like, it's based on a comic, and it's supposed to be hyper stylized, right? It's not an
right.
aspect of reality. You know, 300 guys didn't fight at the Hot Gates, right? Like,
right.
The Spartans weren't, like, the, you know, the be-all and end-all of soldiers. They all died, right?
Right,
the Persians
right.
continued into Greek. Like, there's a whole bunch of, like, Xerxes was never, like, it's just the point of Greek-style, like, and because I have, I have a foundation in sort of, like, classical sort of histories, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's exactly what the Greek sort of stories were. It's like they were super huge propaganda tales that made no sense, right?
Right.
That were incredibly hypocritical, right? That, you know, that don't, like, that are painting, like, the heroes in the rosiest things. And on top of that, it's a movie about a person who is retelling events, right?
Yeah,
and
right.
So it's,
yeah.
none of it is going to be right. It's just his retelling of it, right? The,
right.
the enemies being almost monster-like is just his retelling, right? It's not the
right.
reality. So, but yeah, but Zack Snyder did all this great work for them and then got no love for it, right? And then sort of got shit on with Justice League and the fact that, like, Zack Snyder admitted that he goes, like, he gave it to... He showed, like, the new people at Warner Brothers, like, this stuff, the executive stuff, that no one had seen. And he remarks that, yeah, no one really had looked at his original cut of Justice League before they decided to change it.
That's, like, insane, right? You would think that they would want to take a look at his, what has he done, before they, like, you know, went and chopped it up.
Yeah. And listen, if they did what I hoped they would do, which is just a few reshoots here and there. You know,
yep.
add in a scene with some hilarious dialogue, but not change the story. The story was changed, right? That would have been fine. But what can I say? Zack Snyder's doing better. He's you know, he's doing his Army of the Dead. I wish him. I feel that Zack Snyder's always done better when he's worked with unknown properties and his own properties.
Yeah.
Because there's no expectation, right? There's no, like, you know, inherent bias that someone has to go over. There's no question of, oh, Zack Snyder doesn't understand these characters or whatever, right?
Yeah, but I, you know what? I disagreed with all of those, those opinions when it came to Man of Steel and BVS and Zack Snyder's Justice League.
Yeah.
I mean, I disagree with that. I think he very much does understand his material.
Yeah, and what can I say? I enjoy what he does with it. And what can I say? Like, there was a piece of news that Zack Snyder has been sort of, because of Army of the Dead, on the press tour, sort of explaining himself and explaining things. And he...
Well, it was back-to-back, right? There was the Justice League press tour, and then Army of the Dead press tour.
Yeah, so yeah, he's sort of been, like, in the zeitgeist for a while, from March until May. You know, he's been, you know, constantly pushing it forward, and... What can I say? My problems with Army of the Dead are still there. I still have issues, you know, foundationally with, you know, like, the characterization of the daughter and some of the stuff around it. But the things that, like, upon third viewings, you know, when pointed out to me, the inclusion of UFOs, the inclusion of robot zombies, the time loop theory, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, these are genre stuff that I fall in love with.
Yeah. Right?
And the fact that they're in a zombie movie, which is, like, a genre that, like, I'm going to be very honest, this is a genre that took me a while to really get into, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was deathly afraid of zombies when I was growing up, right? But, you know, it's like one of those things. You just ingratiate yourself in the thing that you hate, and you realize how much you love it.
Okay.
and so, like, the entire zombie genre, and what he did to it, especially because his whole thing was he doesn't want it to be like a normal zombie movie. So, the fact that there's aliens, the fact that there's robot zombies, the fact that there's, you know, a zombie baby, you know,
yeah.
He goes, I put those things all in there, and the best part was, is like the characters in the film are not the characters who are gonna figure it out, right? They're on
right,
a,
yeah.
Like it's like there's like two movies and there's like two or three different movies in this movie, right? And that could cause some issues when it comes to the tone, because definitely, like, you know, I wish that they focused more on the heist, right? But it was also a zombie movie, which means that nothing was going to go to plan. In fact, it was all going to go to hell. In fact, it was going to be really crappy, like the events that they come forward. So all in all, I'm just I'm excited to see what comes forward. And then if Zach is going to be doing more original stuff, he was talking about this new piece of original work that he was going to be doing, so he was in one of the interviews that he was giving, he was explaining that he went to like Lucasfilm, all right, and what pitched to them like a Star Wars movie after the prequels were finished around 2005-ish, to do like a Kurosawa inspired Seven Samurai film, in the Star Wars universe, right? Mm-hmm. And what can I say? Magnificent Seven and Kurosawa are all these really great sort of like, you know, they're great sort of inspirations to take off, especially when you consider
right.
that Star Wars is just a blatant ripoff of like Hidden Fortress, you know,
right.
the Kurosawa film. You know, like just in like, you know, like although you have to remember, like George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, you know, like a lot of their great early work is like Tarantino, just straight, you know, like homages and ripoffs of like, you know, other early work, you know, things like Flash Gordon all the way down to, you know, Hidden Fortress, right?
Yeah.
You know, which, you know, gives us Star Wars, and then Treasure of the Sierra Madre, which gives us, you know, Indiana Jones, right? Like, a lot of these early guys, they base their work, you know, on a lot of early stuff, and where someone like George Lucas never really got out of that, he sort of became a singular, you know, focused person, just focusing in his one universe, you know, and Spielberg expanding his thing. With Snyder, what we're seeing is that he really wants to, like, he wants to do, like, every genre of something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he doesn't want to limit himself. And then even in genres which are well-known and well-done, like the zombie film genre, he adds in, you know, new elements like a heist. He's like, okay, well, let's even go further. Let's, you know, let's add this, you know, aspect of evolution to the zombies, right? First intelligence
right.
and now robotic components and them being able to have children. The very fact that, you know, like, he goes like he wanted to portray it, goes like the minute that they can reproduce without humans, right?
Yeah.
They sort of beat us. And he goes like they don't need any of the stuff that we need. Right?
Yeah.
They don't damage the environment. They're not like, you know, they're all chill with each other. Like zombies
yeah.
don't go to war with each other.
Right? Yeah.
He goes like that's it. It's like we got the world in a level of peace and harmony caused by, you know, zombies who can now have children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. It's this interesting take, and that's what I'm all about. Even if you give me something new and interesting, something that I, you know, something that makes me really hot, even if I've seen it before, but it's done in a new interesting way, you will get a lot out of it. Right? That in and of itself will get a passing grade out of me.
Yeah.
And then after that, you know, it's like you really have to make some really weird and dumb decisions and all that. The thing about a zombie movie is that every dumb decision can be counted up to the fact that it's a zombie movie and people are dumb in zombie movies. Right?
Right.
You know, like people acting dumb in zombie movies is nothing new. Especially now in zombie movies where, like, not only are there special infected, but there's intelligent infected. Yeah, and then his potential Star Wars film, he goes like, now I'm not going to be doing that because it's owned by Disney and everything. But
yeah.
he'll take that idea that he had and just adapt it to, you know, some sort of generic sci-fi setting. And I'm all about that. Yeah, I would love to. Like, when did lightsabers become the exclusive domain of, like, you know, George Lucas? They existed before him. You know, you know, it's like let's start using plasma sabers. Let's have other people, you know, work into this. I can't wait till like Star Wars becomes public domain, right? Under Disney, that might never happen, but you know, like there's plenty of stories that in that world that people can do, and the best part is they don't need to do it in that world. They can just, you know, use the aesthetic and then do the story that they want to tell that may not necessarily fit in that world, but will be cool nevertheless. But, you know, imagine a Zack Snyder Star Wars film. I mean, like, if we thought the fights were cool in the prequel trilogy and shit in the sequel trilogy, I would love to think what would Zack Snyder's, like, he would make lightsaber combat look like the coolest thing in the world.
You know? Yeah, I think it would be cool. Here's the thing, Chris. I'm a huge fan of his. I really do believe that, you know, what he does, I will enjoy no matter what. Right. So it would be really cool if, you know, for him to bring that to life as well.
Yeah. And so, yeah, all in all, there's a whole bunch that we're trying to get into. I'm going to make a recommendation for people. So there was the Bad Batch I made earlier. But similarly, because I've sort of been into the Apple Plus, you know, ecosystem recently, just like going through all of the shows that they have in active development and continuing. There's another Apple Plus show, where I watch something like For All Mankind and Ted Lasso. There's a new one that I'm recommending, which is called Mythic Quest.
Oh, okay. I don't think I've heard of it.
Yeah, so you might think it's not a fantasy show.
Oh, I don't know if I should be disappointed.
Yeah, it's about what's called game developers in making a game called Mythic Quest that's been around for a while. And it's sort of like, you know, they're sort of hijinks while trying to build the game. And as someone who plays games like I do, and even you do, I think you'd really like the hijinks involved in the development process, how crazy and stupid things get. And then, you know, the egos behind the scenes. It's made by a lot of the crew who did It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Okay.
And that's another show I would recommend watching. It's one of those shows that, like, you know, like, either you watch it or you don't. Right, you know.
So I watch it. I like it. I thought it was funny. I, you know, but Bones doesn't, so I have to sort of pick my battles.
What can I say? It's like it's the anti-sitcom, and this one is also very good. And they partnered themselves with Ubisoft, a developer out of France and Montreal, Canada, who gave them a lot of the technical stuff. And they have like the cutscenes that they use in the games and all this sort of stuff are taken from actual, you know, games, major games within the industry, not just from Ubisoft but from others. So, but all in all, I thought it was it's a funny little show. Only half hour long. It's on its second season. They had a quarantine special. They had a continuation special. Like a lot of it was going. So 11 episodes first season, 5 episodes so far in the current season, and more coming out. I would recommend people to just give it a look. It's not so unlike, you know, something like For All Mankind or even Ted Lasso. This one, it's definitely not for everyone, but, you know, I think anyone who's at all a little bit of a gamer would appreciate the sort of, like, you know, comical hijinks of behind-the-scenes game development.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'll definitely be checking it out.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that should about cover it up. I think we can wrap it up.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was a good... Oh, before we wrap it up, let's do a quick organized crime, because we are in the... We've got one more episode left, and... we're in the home stretch. I think they've been nailing it. You and me have talked about it. We love the fact that, you know, per season, it's like one story arc, right? And which makes sense, right? Because... like a case isn't built, investigation isn't done in one episode. It does take several episodes. So I'm glad, you know, that they're exploring that arc. I think it was really well done.
Yeah, the exploration of that arc, of this one season story arc done in in a Law and Order setting, because I believe, like, in the other Dick Wolf inspired shows, like the one Chicago stuff, you know, Chicago Fire, Chicago PD, Chicago Med, and whatever Chicago yeah. shows, like, they all have going on at the same time.
Right.
When it comes to those shows, you really get to determine on a larger scale, on a much mm-hmm. larger scale, like how Dick Wolf in those stories would do if you were able to just really tell the story of a single case over a long period of time. And with organized yeah. crime, it makes sense. They organize it, you know, the time it takes to take down an organized crime syndicate is not going to be done in one episode. And whenever they did yeah. that, it never felt genuine, right?
Right, right.
And so with this one, it's like, all right, organized crime, the 21st century, let's really focus on this new level of organized crime, this new era, and let's sort of, like, give it its you know, its
justice. Right, and, you know, they're talking about the pandemic, they talk about cryptocurrency, because that's, you know,
the new hotness.
Right. I mean, they're keeping it very current as well, which I think is really important. Organized crime. If you guys haven't seen it, definitely start watching it. We have Stabler back, which, you know, Chris and myself, we absolutely love that character. Chris Maloney brings him to life like nobody else can. You know, and I was like really... It was interesting the way they were, you know, how the arcs are going. It looks like they finally have gotten the baddie. And so we've gotten, what, the law part of it, right? It's the order now that we have to wait.
Oh, yeah. We got the law part now. It's just the order. With this final episode, hopefully they decide to really focus in on characters... And yeah, the legal aspect, because it's something that was definitely missing in this episode.
Because with Angela, they were she was, you know, putting, she negotiated an agreement, right? So there was aspects of it where they did bring in the ADA. Some components, but it wasn't as heavy as typically you would see in a Law and Order episode.
Yeah, definitely not. Like I said, I really want to see, like, even if it's like they bring in some of the people who work with, like, the connection between this and SVU is supposed to be huge, right? Like, it's supposed to be
right.
an active part of the show. The SVU and this have a major connection. And so having, like, you know, the ADA who works in SVU pop up and like, do the work, right? I think that's going to be a really cool take on all these characterizations.
Yeah, I agree. I just wanted to, you know, bring in Law and Order Organized Crime just before we ended our episode for this week. And so on that note, you can't what?
Can't solve the sick one, guys. Thanks
for listening. All right. Thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.